Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Whitecaps on the Lake, a novel by Alice Licata, narrated by Rachel LeBlanc. Part 1. Chapter 1. The orange jumpsuit was half hanging off her now. It'd been choking her. She had clawed at it. She couldn't breathe. All her nails were throbbing nubs. Her hands were rubbed raw from gripping the bars until her knuckles turned white. Her cheeks were chafed pink and stinging after trying to stick her head partly through, over and over. She desperately needed to breathe the air outside the bars. She pulled hard through her nose. She yelled out, "Please, please, please, I need air. I can't breathe. There's no air in here." A voice from outside rang out.
"There's air in there. Shut the hell up."
"Please, please, I'm going to die."
"Just shut the hell up. You're not going to die."
"Please, I'm claustrophobic. I can't stay in here. I have to get out. I can't breathe. I'm claustrophobic. Please, let me out. I can't breathe."
"Let you out. Now that's rich. Really rich. For the last time, just shut the hell up."
She glanced at the thick concrete walls surrounding her, and up at the tiny, barred square window, placed far too high to provide any outside view. She tried to take a deep breath, but it stopped short. Her lungs screamed for more air, but they wouldn't fully inflate. "Oh my God, I can't breathe." Her heart pounded like a jackhammer inside her head. Her skull felt like it was about to split wide open. "Oh my God, my head is exploding. My heart is stopping. I'm going to die. I have to get out of here. I can't breathe." She snapped awake then with a start, drenched in sweat and shivering. Her heart raced, punching her ears with every beat. Her insides churned. She felt sick. She stumbled down the hall to the bathroom, tripping on the bath mat in the dark. She reached out for something to break her fall, but went down hard against the commode. The porcelain felt like ice on her cheek. She hoisted up and slung herself over the bowl, heaving and heaving until there was nothing left. Then, she heaved some more. A couple weeks earlier, she'd only gone to the window out of curiosity. Her nosy neighbor, Gladys Kravitz, move. Peeking through the drapes, anticipating something perhaps mildly interesting, who didn't enjoy a little harmless spying. And then... wait. What? Her stomach dropped like a bowling ball off a steep cliff. She wanted to buckle over, collapse right there on the hardwood floor, and curl up tight in fetal position. But like the pathetic moth to the flame, she had to keep watching. She had to see. "Is that a bot?" Her voice caught sharply in her throat. Whoosh! She could feel herself starting to burn up from the inside out. She knew the image of this day would end up seared into her brain. It's how it always went with her. Things singed her. Left marks. Indelible. Like a Sharpie. This turn of events was a tad ironic. The very night before, she'd gone to sleep feeling so satisfied, so blissfully oblivious. Yes, even pleased with herself. She was actually happy again, a minor miracle in itself. She'd only recently been truly lower than low, barely able to crawl through the incessant moments of her life, as if heavy sandbags were attached to her every limb. Her world was about to shatter into smithereens. Yet again. And, like before, the universe hadn't tipped its hand a bit. She had sensed nothing out of the ordinary. Daybreak had crept silently as usual. No fanfare, no hoopla, just, "Here comes the sun again," trusty, molten ball, pregnant with possibility, lingering below the horizon, ready to blaze yet another path through time on the planet it had faithfully cradled for eons. Then, like always, said planet dutifully rotated. The sky had shimmered with pale pinks and soft yellows, signaling uneventful weather ahead. No red skies in the morning sailor's warning for this day. Another bit of irony, since there was, in fact, a fierce storm brewing. Only not the kind with thunder and lightning, high winds or torrential rains. It was to be a disturbance of an entirely different nature. A vicious tornado might have been sincerely welcomed in its place. The ordinariness of the day's beginning indeed belied a grim reality soon to engulf her. That unsuspecting speck of a soul quietly watching out the window. Someone who tried hard to live a decent life. A respectable, well-intentioned, never wanting to hurt a flea sort of life. Sure, a little misguided at times and flawed, even occasionally a bit of a mess, but still a good life. Or at least not a god-awful one. Her hand trembled now as she peeked through the tapestry drapes of the home where she'd grown up. The sprawling red brick ranch house sitting up on a hill, with glossy forest green shutters, bright yellow double front doors, an old-timey bronze rooster weather vane cheerfully perching on the roof. The house seemed to say, "No worries, all's well here." But the ashen face and bleary black eyes peeking out, wide, unblinking pools of panic and dread, would certainly have said otherwise. What she'd seen only moments before had sent piercing alarms and snapping bolts coursing through her brain, pinging every terror switch, zapping every corner, vibrating her every nerve. One glimpse of the outside world that morning had hit her like a monster Mack truck. She was instantly stricken and left teetering over the edge, about to careen off into a deep, dark pit. A bottomless, greedy hellhole. At the window that morning was Imogen Luis Musumeli. The shock to her system would be nothing short of cataclysmic. She was hardly used to the shit hitting the fan. She wasn't somebody who dealt well with calamity, let alone impending doom. She felt sick. Up to this point in her life, she'd mostly skirted catastrophe. Terrible misfortunes happened to other people, she thought. She'd actually come to feel blessed. She was undoubtedly a success story, a standout, even. A girl who'd gone far. Her parents had been especially proud. Her father used to beam. His daughter had a PhD, was Dr. Musumeli, a professor at a prestigious university. She'd note this with embarrassment, though deep down she'd loved being a source of such pride. Yes, that doctorate degree had impressed. Wasn't she just all that? Well, look what the professor had done now. She knew the unexpected swivel her life had suddenly taken would not fuel any pride. Her father would have been appalled. Although unexpected, she wasn't completely surprised. She had a sense that her life might eventually take a turn, some sort of pivot. It'd been only a tiny kernel of belief, a small inkling buried in the recesses of her mind, unseen yet irksome, like a pea under a mountain of royal mattresses. Something was coming. Here, perhaps right on schedule, was that twist, the unequivocal justification for the inkling. The turn, she figured, was that last piece in the jigsaw, proving once and for all she was basically a misfit. Before, she'd sometimes entertained the notion that maybe she was just an outlier, like those described by Malcolm Gladwell in his book. famous good outliers like Bill Gates or Albert Einstein had changed the world. Ha! Huh. She thought. Maybe she'd do something great. Now this. Transfixed, peering out the window of her childhood home, she wondered how she could have miscalculated so badly, been so cavalier, so idiotic. Finding herself in the midst of such an unthinkable crisis, she couldn't help but wonder, how the heck did I get here? She never expected her life to turn out like a Norman Rockwell painting, but now... Her old-world Sicilian-Italian grandmother used to speak of cursed people, hexed by someone who'd put the evil eye, or malocchio, on them. Supposedly, an Italian horn charm could ward this off. Imogen used to wear an 18-karat gold one on a necklace, literally 24/7, as a teen. Having the little gold charm on made her feel especially cool around her friends. Why had she ever stopped wearing it? Buried deep in an old jewelry box somewhere, it was obviously no good to her now. Had Imogen simply been cursed all along? It sounded so unscientific and irrational, and yet... All the way back to when she was merely a tiny girl, the little outlier was like an old worrywart. So many things would rock her. She'd immediately get a bad feeling in the pit of her stomach. But perhaps this trajectory had been inevitable since day one, because, as it happened, Imogen's parents had essentially misnamed her. She was one of six girls born about 2 years apart, named, in descending order, Michaela, Mick, Melanie, Mel, Monica, Mon, Mallory, Mal, Imogen, Im, and Maria, Mar. All the other sisters also had the incidental treat of the initials M.M. M&Ms were an especially popular candy at the time. M&Ms, they melt in your mouth, not in your hand. They loved to call themselves the M&M girls. At some point, Im had asked her mother about not getting an M. Her mother replied, "Oh, we just like the name Imogen. Besides, the second letter is an M. We figured that was close enough. Pretty much the same thing." This, in particular, galled Imogen. It seemed so reckless. And why had they reverted to an M for the youngest? Mrs. Musumeli replied, "Oh, I don't know. We didn't think it would really matter." Wrong? Im had thought. When ticked off with her sister's names, Imogen's would sound out like a flatulent tuba. Someone would invariably say, "Wow, Imogen, you're the oddball." Or, "What happened to Imogen? Why didn't she get an M?" Or it would be, "Mick, Mel, Mon, Mal, Im, Mar." Then,
"Wait a second. Im? I-M? Shouldn't that be M-I? What, is she dyslexic? Ha ha."
Or even,
"Maybe she was adopted. Ha ha."
And so on. Im would crack a small half-smile and lift her shoulders in a shrug without uttering a word. Eventually, she internalized that maybe she was odd. While the reasons were trivial, a little girl really didn't know the difference. She heard,
"You're the oddball," or, "Maybe she's adopted,"
and it would reverberate rudely in her mind. In time, Imogen stuffed her feelings away, pretending not to be bothered, willing herself to act like everything was fine. A person's name wasn't such a big deal, right? But her brick-and-mortar exterior had its holes, and a free-floating sense of angst set up camp within her. Feeling misaligned in the world, like in those early sister lineups, she wondered if she'd always be the one apart. Compounding this, and perhaps related to it, was Imogen's tendency to be easily rattled and spooked as a girl. Fears could spring up willy-nilly like creepy clowns at the circus. A harmless drawbridge near their home had terrified her. Naturally, the bridge had a joint right down the middle and lifted for vessels to pass under. From her little girl eyes, it looked so precarious. With such a big split in it, how could the bridge not collapse with all the heavy cars going over it? Sitting in the way back of the family station wagon, she'd picture their car plunging into the murky water below with everyone trapped inside, petrified faces and hands flattened against the windows, banging to get out. The sound of the car's tires bumping over the ribs of the steel bridge as they traveled over would vibrate her with fear. Eyes squeezed shut, she'd silently pray, waiting to hear the smooth sound of the solid road when they made it to the other side. Im had also been freaked out by the Wizard of Oz movie. It used to air on TV every year. Most kids love it. The whole family would gather to watch. While the Wicked Witch of the West and her winged monkeys gave her the total creeps, for Im, the Twister was the real monster. Was a tornado going to come to their house? During inclement weather, she'd watch the skies like a hawk, on the lookout for any twisters or whatever awful weather might be headed their way. Along Lake Ontario in New York, where the family first lived when Im was very young, squalls could indeed whip up quickly. In winter, lake effect snow would blanket their home and street, smothering trees and shrouding cars. Her father would completely disappear, shoveling the driveway, surrounded by huge walls of packed ice and snow. She imagined an avalanche could even bury a small girl, alive, in her own yard. And the nearby Great Lake would often grow wild, spawning frothy whitecap waves, furiously bashing the rocky shore. Imogen knew that big whitecaps on the lake usually meant something bad was on the way. A storm, thunder, lightning, heavy rain, hail, gale-force winds, a blizzard. Pummeling the rocks, the ferocious surf seemed eager to engulf anything in its path. No one could survive the giant lake's wrath, and it was right there, practically in their backyard, vast and looming, poised to swallow up anything or anyone that got too near or fell off the cliff. The Musumeli's Rochester home had, in fact, been on a street running along a steep bluff on Lake Ontario, actually the highest point on the lakeshore between Syracuse and Buffalo. Local history deemed it a favorite spot for bootleggers in the 1920s, waiting for their whiskey to arrive from Canada. The elevation made it the ideal location to look out for the boat shuttling the booze, but it could also be treacherous. Before Im was born, a man in one of the houses abutting the cliff had fallen to his death there. Suicide was at first suspected, but it turned out there had been unseen erosion under the craggy edge. Insidiously, it had looked completely solid. The man's old house was a Spanish-style mansion with gloomy windows and tall spires that taunted her every time she innocently rode by on her little bike. The house seemed to whisper, "I eat little girls like you for lunch." Im had imagined it having tendrils suddenly reaching out to snatch her. A cold shiver would run down her spine. She'd heard about the guy who used to live there, that he was leisurely strolling out in his own backyard when the ground suddenly gave way right under his feet. No warning, no sign, just one misstep, and he was dead. Death. Even as a tiny girl, Im knew it was very bad. The worst thing. And it seemed it could happen any time in the big world out there, a place that might instantly give way, suddenly erupt, swallow you whole, bury you alive, or whisk up your house and drop it down in a scary foreign land where an evil witch tries to steal your dog and kill you. Dead. Indeed, when Im was small, the Musumeli family was abruptly uprooted from their northeast home. As it happened, many industrial companies were expanding at the time, and Mr. Musumeli's automotive one needed engineers at a brand new plant in Ohio. When moving day arrived, a huge Allied truck appeared and strange large men walked through their house, boxing and loading up all their possessions. Imogen remembered sitting in a corner, clenching her favorite stuffed animal as their home was being torn apart all around her. Finally, they said goodbye to their cozy neighborhood in Rochester, New York, and boarded the airplane for Ohio. It was her first time on a plane. Her stomach was full of butterflies as she peered out the tiny round window. She'd seen photos on TV of the aftermath of a plane crash. Debris scattered, and white, bloated bodies floating in the dark water. Would they be flying over any water? Of course, they made it safely to Ohio, landing in the sprawling suburbs of Dayton. Situated in the southwestern part of the state, it was quintessential Midwest. Landlocked and drab, it could be another planet. It felt like being in the boondocks. None of the girls was thrilled, but being that outlier, Imogen was thrown for a major loop. In Rochester, Im had begun to feel happy, even secure. Now, she suddenly felt out of place. In fact, her entire Italian-American family stuck out in their new town like a giant, greasy thumb. Nobody looked like them. Nobody acted like them. Nobody talked like them. Everyone had a funny Southern Ohio accent saying things like, "Have you got a pin?" when they meant pen, or saying "git" instead of "get." And the Musumeli girls laughed at the rampant bad grammar, as in, "I'm gonna get me some," or, "I seen him yesterday," and the double negatives, "He don't want none," or, "I ain't gonna tell nobody nothing," or ending a sentence with a dangling "at," as in, "Where's it at?" or, "Where's the party at?" It all seemed so hickish. Plus, most of the Ohio girls were fair-haired and light-eyed, with translucent skin, rosy cheeks, and cute freckles. The Musumeli girls had complexions that tanned deeply in the summer and faded to a sallow, olive tone in the winter, and they all had deep, mahogany eyes and full dark eyebrows, along with thick heads of inky, brown-black hair. Where had they come from? And then, what about the twisters? Tornadoes were much more likely in hot, humid, flat Ohio than upstate New York. After all, the setting for The Wizard of Oz, Kansas, was in the heart of the Midwest, just like Ohio. Plus, Em had overheard her parents discussing a place called Tornado Alley in Ohio. Was this anywhere near their new house? Im soon had the Ohio National Weather Service phone number memorized and dialed it on the black rotary phone in their basement multiple times a day to hear the forecast. She proclaimed that she wanted to be a weather girl when she grew up and studied the daily newspaper weather map. At 4:30 each afternoon, she'd be sitting on the driveway waiting for the evening edition of the newspaper. She also had developed a secret crush on the paperboy, so her heart would skip a beat as soon as his bike rounded the bend. It was the best part of her day. Then, newspaper in hand, she'd race into the house, spread the paper out on the family room floor, and turn directly to the weather page. Inspecting the large map of the country, she checked the local forecast, taking note of low-pressure cells or storm fronts headed their way. When she saw the big H for high pressure hanging over Ohio, meaning no storms, no lightning, no thunder, surely no tornadoes, she got a warm, good feeling. She could breathe easier for another day. In retrospect, maybe the weather fixation gave young Imogen a small sense of control in the midst of a world where she felt so little. Vulnerability and lack of control are inherent in childhood, but for whatever reason, Im became acutely aware of this, along with her smallness and insignificance in the universe, the fragility of life, and in turn, the absolute dreadfulness of death. Religion and God might have been of some solace to her in this regard, had she been able to get her mind around it, but her precocious little self secretly questioned it all. How could it really be true? How do you accept it without question? Yet most around her seemed to. Sunday Mass was a must for the whole Musumeli family, and Im's Italian grandmother walked to church at least 3 times a week with her lady friends and prayed the full rosary every morning and every night. The rosary beads held such power for them, making worries disappear, calming nerves, keeping loved ones safe. Im wished she could have bought into all this, too. Of course, being part of a Roman Catholic family, Imogen still received all the holy sacraments, although even in this she proved to be the outlier. When it was time for her to go to the Saturday Communion Preparation Classes, CCD, she flat out refused.
"I can't go, Mom."
"Why not?"
"I don't know. I just don't want to go."
"But Im, your sisters have all done it."
"I know, but I just can't, Mom. Please don't make me go."
Tears flowed, heels dug in. What the heck was wrong with her? Finally, an emergency one-on-one meeting with the Mother Superior of the church was arranged. As she was led alone into the nun's austere office, Im's face grew hot. Her eyes watered and her throat clamped shut. She stood still and silent as the nun hugged her for what seemed like an eternity. The rustling of the nun's habit and the feeling of the stiff, starched collar against her nose were forever etched in her brain. Was the nun trying to hug the devil out of her? There could have been no other explanation for Im's insubordination. Petrified, she never spoke a word to the Mother Superior that day. The nun couldn't have understood that her obstinate refusal to attend CCD had nothing to do with getting the sacraments or being possessed by the devil. It was only that she was terrified of the parochial school, a place she'd never been, full of children she didn't know. She'd already just been there and done that. When the Musumelis moved to Ohio, it was smack dab in the middle of her first grade year. Going through the heavy wooden doors at the new school for the first time felt like walking the plank. All eyes fixed on Im as she scooted into her seat in the last row by the door. She wanted to melt into the wall. Her stomach clenched in tight knots. Everything seemed foreign and strange. Even the school building itself scared the bejesus out of her. Spooky high ceilings, huge dark rafters, thick old plaster walls, clunky gray metal desks, heavy glass block windows. Nothing like the bright, airy, modern school she'd left behind in Rochester. Her first day at the new school also turned out to be picture day. School portraits back then were usually in black and white. The children were explicitly told not to wear white shirts or blouses, presumably to prevent a floating head photo when the child's white-clad torso disappeared into the background. Having not received this instruction, Im wore an all-white knit top with a red, blue, and green plaid pleated skirt. The teacher tried to calm the rest of the students, but there were whispers and snickers about her being in white. And later, whenever Im tried to speak out in class at the new school, her cheeks burned and her windpipe constricted. She could barely produce a sound. Thankfully, she did, in time, make friends with another little brown-eyed girl, and she was overjoyed. But then, without warning, the girl's family abruptly moved out of town. Standing alone in the middle of the playground, Imogen watched, a huge lump in her throat, as her new best friend climbed into the back seat of her family's sedan and disappeared. Whisked up and gone for good. Eventually, a year later than usual, Imogen did receive her first communion, to the great relief of her parents and family. And she tried to be a good Catholic, praying hard at church, kneeling in the pew, gazing up at the cross, going to confession, asking God for forgiveness, dipping her fingers in the holy water, signing the cross, and genuflecting. But something inside her was hedging, and ultimately lack of attendance at Mass and confession left her dangling.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?